Nepal was in the headlines last month when King Gyanendra closed down its government and seized full control of the state. Although Nepal's political situation remains quite chaotic, another major crisis looms as well. Joining me now as part of our weekly underreported feature are two human rights workers from Nepal, Rita and Nina. Both false names because they want to protect their families back home. And they're joined by Julia Friedson, director of Watch List on Children in Armed Conflict. I'm very pleased to welcome you all to the Leonard Lopate Show. Rita and Nina, you've chosen to use false names here. How dangerous is it to work as a human rights activist in Nepal?
I think at this point, it's quite dangerous, especially to say anything against the monarch or the military military government we have right now. I would say military government. So therefore, it's very, very sensitive for us to really not disclose our names because we want to go back. We want to live in our own country. So therefore, it's very important.
Now, Rita, I understand that telephones have just been reopened. So are you able to talk to people back home now?
Yes, I was able to talk to my family back home, but since the cell phone doesn't work, so all the time we are in confused whether our family back in our home are in proper shape or not, whether they are arrested by the security forces or they are doing the job.
And the phone lines are tapped, so that's also something to think of.
How long have you both been involved in human rights work in Nepal?
For me, it's been about 12 years.
And to me, it's 7 years plus.
Would you have been as concerned about hiding your identities before King Gyanendra seized control?
No.
Never. Actually, this is my first time where I really had to think that I should not disclose my identity.
Mm-hmm. But suddenly you have another thing to fear.
Yes.
Were you in the country when the king declared the state of emergency last month?
Yes, both of us.
So what happened to the both of you during that time?
Were
the organizations that you were working for specifically targeted because they were human rights organizations?
Yes, since we focus on civil and political rights, and we have working on the Lifeline. It's a project to save the person who is in risk of his life. So it was targeted by security forces because we have registered the case-wise issue of the human rights violation.
If just by reporting that there were problems, you put yourself in danger.
Yes.
We raise a lot of issues that's basically human rights violation throughout the country. And I think that's why we were targeted, if our phone lines were tapped. And for about 2 weeks, we didn't know what or how to go about in terms of going ahead with our work. So we really had to, it was a very difficult situation, not knowing what next and not being able to communicate was amazing. I have never experienced in my life what can happen with no telephone lines.
Now, the king claimed that it was because of the Maoist insurgency that he was forced to do this because the government that was in place was not being very effective in fighting it. When did that Maoist insurgency begin?
It started in 1996, and the insurgency has not decreased, let's say, in last 1 month. I think it has escalated in much larger scale than before.
With the government crackdown?
Yes, because the problem is only Kathmandu Valley is controlled by the government. Even I would say the periphery parts of the valley is not in control by the government. But if you go beyond the valley in different parts of Kathmandu, it's only very small part of the district headquarters which is controlled by the government. Rest are in control by the Maoists. So I don't see the point how it's going to really make a difference if the king is only going to really take over Kathmandu Valley and that insurgency is going to be controlled. I find no link to it.
So the Maoists are so successful that they control most of the country, everything but the capital city and its near surroundings?
With the violence, they had been able to do it. And in some parts, it's without violence, too. So if you really talked to the people I have talked to, what they have said is that they are more afraid. This is outside Kathmandu, not inside Kathmandu. In Kathmandu, I think in a lot of some people, I wouldn't say a lot, some people are happy that the king had taken over. But if you look at the outside the valley, a lot of people whom I have talked to, so, you know, that doesn't mean all of people, but whom I have talked to, they said that they are more scared of the army than of the Maoists.
Even though the Maoists seem to be a very violent group. We had a guest on this show some time back who compared them to the Shining Path insurgents of Peru rather than any real Maoists. You're nodding your head, Julia. Julia, you should jump into this.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having us. The Watchlist on Children and Armed Conflict is a network of non-governmental organizations. We recently released a report entitled Caught in the Middle, Mounting Violations Against Children in Nepal's Armed Conflict. And I think that title, Caught in the Middle, really gets at the answer.
I want to get to the children
question,
in a moment. But
which is that the both parties to the conflict, the Maoists and the government armed forces, are responsible for violations. And the Maoist insurgency has taken a very violent turn since it began in 1996.
But it's been mostly successful, obviously, in the rural areas. Still, people have been displaced, haven't they?
There are a lot of people displaced, especially those people who have dissenting voice, especially those people who have different political ideology.
Whether they are anti-Maoist or in the Maoist-controlled areas, the king, if they're in the king's
It doesn't
controls.
Matter who. It's just anyone who doesn't have their views, their political values. A lot of people have been displaced. Actually, if you look at around December, when there was an attack in Dailek, which is the far western mountain district, there were as many as 3,000 people, especially men, and some boys migrating to India. So there is that dissent too. People, it doesn't mean that people, although they are successful, that they all agree with what the Maoists have been doing. And they are very violent, especially if they don't agree with them.
Both sides, the insurgency and counterinsurgency, are targeting civilians. Is there even a better option between these two points? Is anybody out there offering a third way?
I think the third way only can be the negotiation. There's no third. The democratic government, I would say, would be the third way. And in that means, I think, both the Maoist and the king has to come within that system. I don't see any other alternative. And especially with what's happening, I really feel democratic government is very, very important for most people.
Julia, how does Nepal's human rights record compare to other countries throughout the world?
That's a very good question. Actually, one of the things that we were struck by putting together this report about violations against children is that the spectrum of violations that children generally face, children and adolescents, I should say, generally face during armed conflict ranges from killing and maiming, abductions, lack of access to education and health care, child soldiering, rape, sexual violence, this whole spectrum of things that you think about when you think about places like Sudan and northern Uganda, and when you think about Liberia or Congo or Colombia.
Sierra Leone,
the whole range. You know, these places come to mind. And we were struck pulling together information about violations in Nepal because children and adolescents in Nepal are facing this same spectrum of violations.
For the same reasons, do you think? Or are they unique to to Nepalese history?
Well, in fact, every conflict, every context has its own reasons, its own history, and its own slight differentiation in how and why these violations are perpetrated. But generally speaking, it's caught in the crossfire. It's voluntarily joining armed forces because you have no other options, or it's forced recruitment, forced abduction, and just because of the situation, its lack of access to things like education and health care because of an armed conflict situation.
Was Nepal in better shape before the Maoist insurrection? After all, there was the king who was then later killed by his son, the brother of the current king, isn't it? Was everything nice? Were there no human rights violations before the Maoists started messing things up, and then we had this fratricide of the king?
Actually, what I would say is there was negative peace. There was what seemed to be peaceful. There was structural violence. There was social injustice. And I think that is the cause why this whole conflict started. I mean, if a lot of times people don't even know that Nepal is an extremely diverse country with 59 ethnic groups, with 109 different languages and dialects, with different religions. So,
but mostly Hindu, isn't it?
I wouldn't say mostly Hindu, because I think there is a real differentiation in skewed data in terms of data, I would say. Because if you look at really the northern mountains, it's mostly Buddhist. But if you look at other sites, it's in the plains, it's, I would say, Hindus. But if you look at different middle mountains, there are a lot of different other religions. So I would say it's I wouldn't exactly say, although statistically Hindu seems to be the major religion in Nepal, I wouldn't exactly say so. So there was no respect for diversity, and I would say that was one of the root causes of conflict.
And whose fault was that? Was it the royal family's fault, or was it just because the culture that was in place led to inequities?
I would say it's the culture that was put in place. I wouldn't say exactly the king.
Mm-hmm. So now your work has also focused mainly on women and children and how they become victimized. So is that how you wound up meeting Julia?
I guess so, because I had been doing some researches on, especially on conflict and with children and women. So that's how we started our communication and started our relationship. And especially if you're talking about the earlier time, especially elder women were very respected, unlike, I would say, here in Western culture. But if you look at it now, that is totally destroyed in terms of with the conflict. It has really destroyed a lot of the structures of the system. And when I was younger and I had a friend from Uganda, she used to tell me about all the conflict. And I just couldn't understand what it was all about. But now I can relate to it because then violence was not part of our life. When one person dies, we are killed. It is the news for years, but not any longer.
When we come back, let's talk about why children have been targeted as we continue this unreported look into the current situation in Nepal, where human rights violations are occurring on both sides of an insurrection and have increased since the king seized power. This is WNYC. I am talking with Julia Friedson, director of Watch List on Children in Armed Conflict, and two human rights workers from Nepal, Rita and Nina. Those are the names they would prefer I use today because they are concerned about protecting their families back home. We're back with Underreported, looking at Nepal with Julia Friedson, director of Watch List on Children in Armed Conflict, and with Rita and Nina, both using false names. They are human rights workers from Nepal. Now, Nepal is in an area that has experienced conflict. Some of their neighbors have experienced conflict as well. Bhutan right now has serious problems. Has that had an effect on the stability of the country?
I think it was the other way around, because when we had democracy in 1991, I think Bhutanese government or the king felt threatened because the Lhotshampas, who are of Nepali origin, he got threatened by that because they were starting to really kind of demand for their own identity rights in terms of, you know, and also some of them were. And the population itself was quite large. I think that's really threatened the king, and therefore they had the ethnic cleansing.
Well, we mentioned children. Children have been particularly victimized. Are children targeted both by the government and the Maoist forces? Rita?
Yes, there's a forced recruitment from the rebel side. And
They just go into a town and they just take all the kids?
Yes, it's like they abduct a student from the schools, and then they forcefully recruited as a soldier. It's from the rebel side.
So what happens now if schools are being attacked? Does that mean that people are afraid to send their kids there?
Yes, especially in the village side out of the Kathmandu Valley, they just take out the children who are educated so that they can teach and they can train them easily. And the parents, especially in the far in the remote places, they don't send their children to the school with the threat that they might be abducted by the rebel group.
So how do you imagine this will affect the generation that's been born into this conflict? Will they lose the ability to read? Will they be undereducated? That could have drastic effects in 20 years from now, can't it?
I just can't imagine what will be the future of the of the coming generation without school and with all the weapons and everything.
Now they have the Maoists have a policy which is one house, one person. So it could be a child, anybody. So
just give us a soldier to fight the government.
Yes. But it's at the same time also the army is doing the same thing. They are also using the children as informers. So I think they are caught in between both from the Maoist and the army. So it's not one, I wouldn't say one-sided at all. And a lot of mothers, because a lot of fathers have migrated. There are lots of villages where there are no men. So a lot of mothers, they need the help of children so to do the agricultural work. And so therefore, they are spending more time. They prefer to spend more time at their tilling the land or stay home. So a lot of them are now not going to school. And that is going to make a big impact in terms of what their future is going to be, what opportunities they are going to have, what's their development will be like.
But we have not talked about whether people are fully committed to either of these causes. Are they just simply being forced to fight for one side or another? Or are there a lot of people who believe in the Maoist cause? Are there a lot of people who support the old regime?
Actually, I think a lot of times in the villages, I think the rural villages, let's not get into cities, because in the cities, I think there is still a lot of support for this regime or the democratic system. But in the rural area, a lot of people, in some ways or other, either they are forced or they have willingly accepted. As I said before, there was a lot of discriminations for ethnic minorities, for lower castes. So a lot of those people, they think that, I'm saying they think that they might get social justice.
Right, this has become a peasant revolt.
There's a lot of support, I would say. I wouldn't say exactly peasant revolt, because sometimes they rather would just go along with the flow rather than go against it. So I wouldn't say exactly peasant rebellion, because if you look at the leaders, they are very highly educated. And if you look at the lower level, now there is criminals who are really... who have been criminalized by the system. Who have committed crimes are also joining. So I wouldn't say exactly peasant movement either.
In the earlier days also, I think there may have been some hope that some relief would be found in this alternative. But as the movement became more and more violent, it's less and less popular among the rural population, but yet they're forced in many different circumstances to take part or are accused of taking part even when they don't.
Now, Julia, you mentioned earlier some of the other places where there have been child soldiers forced into these conflicts: Liberia, Sierra Leone, Congo, Uganda, Sri Lanka, we didn't mention. But we haven't heard about this aspect in the Nepali conflict. Why do you think that is? Is the situation in Nepal underreported in the West, or at least in the United States?
Absolutely. I think this is an incredibly underreported story. I have been to Nepal a few times in the past year, and when I speak with people in the West, they say, now, isn't there some kind of Maoist thing going on there? I think there's very little information getting out, which was one of the reasons we tried to create this report to give a comprehensive picture about what's happening. I think people think about Nepal and have ideas of Mount Everest and a nice vacation in place. But in recent years, with this conflict, things have changed dramatically, and there's a real lack of information out there about what's happening.
Do you have any idea of why? Is it just that Nepal is too small for the American radar?
I'm not sure that's the case.
Because it used to be a very popular place for people to go, at least in the 60s and 70s.
Absolutely. I think Nepal for so long has been considered a country where development work happens, and people have put a lot of development effort and time into Nepal. And so it's been considered very much a development context. And in Kathmandu, where the information center is, there's still very a sense that things aren't as bad as they are out in the rural areas. And so the information that makes it to the West is generally coming from Kathmandu, where there's a real sense, or at least before February 1st, there's been a real sense that, well, things will get better, we should just wait.
But that development has depended on the largesse of other countries like the United States, like India, its huge neighbor. Weren't there protests when the king seized power? And didn't people threaten to cut down on the funding?
Actually, yes. Two important angles here, and maybe Nina and Rita want to add in. But after the king's declaration of the state of emergency, both India and the United Kingdom have withdrawn military assistance, which is a very important statement. And the United States has recently come out and said that they're also considering withdrawing military assistance. And we very much urge the government of the United States to actually take that step, like India and the United Kingdom, of withdrawing military assistance in the situation. Development assistance is another story.
In terms of development assistance, like Danida, what they have done is they have frozen all the support to the government, but they are funding the civil society. So I think that is a good approach to take, because I think a lot of activities depend on external funding. So I think the military aid has to be suspended. But in terms of other humanitarian funding, I think that would be a good approach to take, how Danida did.
As we've seen in other places where humanitarian funding has been cut back, in Iraq, for example, that seemed to be counterproductive. We had a guest on recently who said that our policies towards Burma have been a disaster. We have not really in any way help to resolve the situation there, and yet we've caused a lot of trouble, a lot of pain and suffering for the Burmese people as a result of the sanctions. You're saying don't apply sanctions, just withdraw support of the government?
Yeah, withdraw support from to the government, and especially any kind of military aid.
But what happens if the Maoists then gain control as a result of that? Wouldn't that be counterproductive?
You know, I really think that in some ways, even with the very sophisticated weapons, the army has not been able to really get in control of the Maoist, because I think we are not fighting a regular contemporary war. We are fighting a guerrilla warfare. So I don't think, you know, the kind of army military weapons is going to make that much of a difference. I think it increases the power of the army, and in some ways, it's not accountable power. So I think that really is creating more problem than really solving anything. But I think what it could be done is how to make the Maoists come into negotiating table, I think would be more appropriate, because otherwise it's just not going to be a no-win situation. And to some extent, I mean, my analysis might not be exactly right, but I think in some ways they are also not very powerful enough to really take over, let's say, Kathmandu. So I think there is a space for negotiation.
My guests are Nina and Rita, two human rights workers from Nepal, and also I've been talking with and am talking with Julia Friedson, director of the Watch List on Children in Armed Conflict. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. By the way, if you would like to see the report from Watch List about violations against children in Nepal's armed conflict, you can access it through a link on our show page at WNYC.org. So how likely are negotiations between the Maoists and the government? Is this something that we can predict in the near future?
I don't think we can predict in near future.
Is the king the one who's most obstinate about it, or are the Maoists demanding complete victory or nothing?
No, actually, the Maoists have asked for negotiation with the king because they thought that the political parties or the government, which were heading a month before, were not powerful enough to really come to negotiating table when they would go back in their words. So I think there is a space. But it's not at this point, I don't think the king is looking at negotiation, and which would be, I really feel if something is not really done soon, there will be a lot of bloodshed
of innocent
people.
But the king is saying that he's fighting terrorists, and that is something that many countries are concerned about. And the Maoists are terrorists, aren't they?
I don't know how to, you know, it's, I think it all depends on how you interpret it, I would say. They think that they're fighting for a cause, you know, the king is saying he's fighting for a cause, so I wouldn't go into that, you know, because I think that's a whole different debate. But I think it's really important to really see what are the common people's need, what are the human rights violation of common people, why is this movement, why did it grow so rapidly? It was amazing from how it started in 96 in a very, very small way from few districts in Rolpor, Rukum, Salyan, Jajarkot, how it spread throughout the country. I think we really need to go to the root cause of that.
And in the year 2000, was it? 2001, 2002, there was a previous state of emergency as a result of the insurgency. How was that resolved, Rita? Or why was it lifted? Because did things get better for a while?
No. At the time, according to the king, he had given some time to revise the work of the present government. So it was lifted because it crossed the limitation of imposing the state of emergency. And once again, in last February, they have again imposed the state of emergency. But it was... I just wanted to add... in connection to what Nina said, that we're very deeply appreciated by the government of India and Britain to suspend the military aid. But however, again this time, the king's new regime, they had been reluctant to respond to the concern of international community. And they have continued to suppress the democratic rights and the civil and civil liberties beyond the scope of state of emergency. For instance, there is a Royal Commission for Corruption Control with the investigation and judicial, which is very much politically motivated kind of commission. And
I mean, anyone who speaks out immediately goes to jail.
If
there's really no freedom of speech or freedom of press right now.
Exactly. There is complete censorship on the media. You can't speak against the king. And if you do so, then you'll be charged by this commission for the corruptions and beyond.
Now, Julia, what's happening with the refugees? Most of them have gone across the border to India. So we have this odd situation where refugees from Bhutan are coming into Nepal, and then Nepalese are going into India. Is India prepared to handle an influx of people?
Actually, there are two situations. One is that people are fleeing across the border into India, and we know very little about what's happening for these Nepalese once they reach India, although we do have a few examples of people who have been able to go over and assess the situation, have found very dire circumstances of people who have both left out of fear for their lives, left for economic purposes, or been trafficked. The other side of this is that there are people who have fled their homes and villages for the same reasons and not crossed over the border into India, but are staying inside district headquarters in Nepal. So they've become internally displaced, and they're also facing very vulnerable situations. Very little is known. Actually, there's no real assessment right now about what's happening for them, but we do know that there are no direct service provisions being made for them, either by the government, by the UN, or by other non-governmental organizations. So there are two scenarios. The Bhutanese refugees is a third on top of that.
King Gyananda claims that he's trying to make Nepal more democratic. Do you believe him when he says that?
Well, we all have hopes that Nepal will become more democratic. I mean, that's certainly the goal here. But it does seem ironic that withdrawing civil liberties and dissolving the government is a way to make things more democratic. We certainly wouldn't expect that to be the route to go. In terms of the humanitarian crisis, as we were talking about before, I think one of the problems, as I said, is that so little is known. And there is a role here for the UN in assessing the humanitarian situation and ensuring that in the time that the politics are being worked out, those who are most vulnerable and really in a very tight humanitarian bind without access to food or medical services have the provisions that they need in order to survive.
For example, the World Bank was supposed to give $70 million in aid to Nepal and decided not to after the king seized power and dissolved the government. Well, do you still have high hopes for this whole thing working out, Nina?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the civil liberties has to be reinstated. And without that, I don't think we'll have a democratic government, regardless of whatever has been said. When people are arrested, when there's extrajudicial, arresting, I think there's a lot of problems with it. So, there are a lot of people who are nominated in power who has very, very ancient way of thinking of how government should run. So I don't think that it's going to be a democratic government for a while, and I don't think it is sustainable, because at this day and age where a lot of people, especially younger people who have studied all over the world and who has gotten information, I would say Kathmandu, I wouldn't say Nepal. Kathmandu had really gotten into modern technology, modern development in really very, very, within a short span, they have probably leaped many times. So I don't think it'll be possible really to get back into the system where we had before. And I don't think it's a possibility.
Well, I want to thank you all so much for being on the show today, Nina and Rita, two human rights workers from Nepal, and Julia Friedson, director of Watchlist on Children in Armed Conflict. Their report about violations against children in Nepal's armed conflict is available through a link on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you all so much.
Yes,
thank you.
Yes, before we end up, I would like to request the international media to carry the news, because the local media cannot carry out the news, as there is a highly censorship on the fourth state of our country. So I would like to request all the international media to carry out the real picture of Nepal time and again.
Well, if people out there who want to pursue an important story, reporters are looking for something, well, Nepal. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.